OCTalkRadio.net.
Welcome, everybody. It's time for a special edition here, a special show, which we call OC Spotlight, where we take a look at some of the topics in the news today and some of the people making news as well. We try and find the most amazing people doing the most incredible things right here in our own backyard, right here in Orange County. And today, we're going to take it a little broader than we usually do. Normally, we're just focused on Orange County discussions, but we have a special guest coming through town, and I wanted to take the opportunity to meet him and to pick his brain on all of our behalf, because as you'll hear in a moment, he's here to talk about a topic that is splashed all over the news these days. So welcome, if you would, Kareem Balchi. Did I say that even close to correct here?
No, it's quite good.
Kareem is, or Karim, as I think he says, is an expert in Middle East politics, a columnist from Today's Zaman. Is that how you pronounce it?
And yes,
that
indeed.
Today's Zaman is what, a newspaper?
It's a daily newspaper in Turkey, published in English.
And you're also the chief of the Turkish Review, which I take is a foreign policy publication?
It's a foreign policy publication, a bi-monthly.
Okay. So it's sort of like Foreign Policy or Foreign Affairs or one of those publications.
Yes.
Here. All right. Well, what in the world brings you to our spot of the world? What brings you all the way across continents here to Orange County?
Let me tell first what brings me out of Turkey.
Right.
I am blacklisted by the Turkish government.
Oh, wow. Is that why there are helicopters flying around outside looking for you here?
I hope not. the Turkish government is unfortunately consolidating power in the hands of one man, the president of the country, Mr. Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
Right.
And they don't like the opposition media. Yeah, and I happen to be one of the opposition journalists in the country. So they took me out of the country. It's a self-imposed exile to prevent any possible arrest.
So you're not going back then to Turkey the foreseeable future here?
Well, when the president goes out of the country, I will turn back to the country.
Okay. Well, all right. So, and specifically, you're here at the invitation of the Pacifica Institute. Give us a quick overview of what the Pacifica Institute. I looked it up in the internet, and I confess I had never heard of it before, and shame on me, because it's quite a large organization with a lot of branches, one of which happens to be here in Orange County. What do they do?
In fact, Pacifica Institute operates in the West Coast cities of the United States. It's an organization basically of the Turkish diaspora living in the United States, trying to help the Turkish community to better integrate into the greater American society and help the American society to understand the dynamics of Middle Eastern politics and culture.
And is there a large Turkish diaspora, as we say, is a group of people who would probably prefer to live in their home country, but for various reasons have left and have formed communities elsewhere? Is there a large Turkish community here in America, and specifically Orange County?
Well, in fact, quantitatively speaking, the numbers are not huge, but qualitatively speaking, I can assuredly say the Western Coast is a beautiful place for Turkish engineers, you know, working in Silicon Valley and similar engineering compounds, and universities in the West Coast do host many Turkish academics, mainly on Turkey, Islam, Middle East, Central Asia, and so on. They are able to set the tone of the discussion in this part of the world.
If there is a Turkish center in Orange or in America here today, where do most Turks live? For example, here in Orange County, we have the largest population of Vietnamese diaspora expatriates. Mm-hmm. We also have obviously large Hispanic populations, and on the edge of Orange County, a very large Indian community. We have a large Persian community here, a large Chinese community, ever growing Chinese community. Where, if I were going to find the majority of Turk expatriates, where would I find them? What state?
Well,
what area?
It is actually in New Jersey. The famous Patterson neighborhood is known to be the Little Turkey in the United States.
I've been to Patterson, New Jersey, yeah.
And in fact, there is already a Turkish cultural center in Patterson.
And is there a Turkish consul here in the West Coast or anything? Or is that only on the East Coast, like New York or something?
No, there is a consul general in L.A. Apart from that, I don't know the details if there is any other. But the Turkish Airlines is already flying directly from Istanbul to L.A. So this is certainly a new destination for Turkish businessmen.
Now I'm going to tell you what little I know of Turkey here in my own background. I've always been fascinated with foreign affairs, studied it in college 100 million years ago at the University of Michigan, wrote my senior honors thesis on the Nixon-Kissinger foreign policy and its impact on the Cold War. So I've had a fascination with foreign affairs probably more than most Americans have for most of my life here. And what I've heard about Turkey is this. It seems to be at a crossroads, not just a crossroads geographically between Europe and the Middle East, which has always been its place there. Go look it up on the map. It's right in between these two areas. It's right at the, the Bosporus Straits that allows you from the Mediterranean into the Black Sea there. It's where Constantinople and the Eastern Roman Empire was and all that for generations. So it's played a very critical point geographically. Been a bridge between these two cultures and these two areas. But it seems like even more so, it's at a historical crossroads, which is to say, is it an Islamic state or is it an European state? It seems to have one foot in both worlds.
In fact, that discussion is not only about Turkey. Turkey has been going and coming in between, secular democratic country, a member of the European Union, and turning back to its Middle Eastern roots. The discussion back in Turkey is about whether Turkey can serve, as it traditionally did, as a kind of bridge maker between the East and West,
right,
between Islam and Judeo-Christian traditions, or it will be a part of either one of those.
Right.
Unfortunately, under the current Justice and Development Party, Turkey moved away from its Western orientation, usually by the foreign policy experts, a shift of axis from the West towards the East. This shift of axis does not only mean a shift towards the Middle East, but it means also a shift towards the Iranian, Chinese, and Russian axis. Turkey has been a member of the NATO alliance from 1956 onwards. So the years that you studied in Michigan University, the Cold War, is actually coming back.
It seems like it. And let's give a little history. I had to look some of this up myself and remind myself here. Obviously, Turkey, for a long period of its history, was the Ottoman Empire. And that as that Ottoman Empire fell apart, there was a unique secular turn. And was that Ataturk?
It was the founder of the Republic, Mustafa Kemal Ataturk.
And they really, as I understood it, the idea was we're going to become more of a secular society and less of a religious state.
It is indeed. But one thing has to be underlined. The Ottoman Empire was not a religious state also. Ottoman Empire was not at all an Islamic empire. Muslims were always in minority in Ottoman Empire. Ottoman Empire was largely the inheritor of the Byzantine Empire, and it was largely a Christian empire. The ruling family, the family of Osman, which the empire took its name, was a Muslim Turkish family. That was all what Muslim was about, the Ottomans.
And didn't they, at different times, and maybe I'm wrong in this, but didn't they at different times profess to be the caliphate, the Islamic world, right?
For about 3.5 centuries, the Ottoman sultans were also the caliphs of the Muslim world, but in their own understanding, even the caliphate didn't mean a religious office, it was rather a secular political office. But of course, Ottomans had a special millet system where every different religious group professed their own religion. So the Jews, for example, running their civic law according to the Jewish religion and the Christians according to the Christian religion. It was a kind of parallel law that was running on. It was not necessarily only Islamic. It was Islamic, Jewish, and Christian at the same time.
Okay.
This is called the millet system. But the by the turn of the 20th century, of course, a secular republic was established. There had been difficult times by means of adaptation into a secular environment. But rather than becoming a secular, it was more difficult to become a nation, because to forge a nation state out of an empire is always painful.
Yes, as the Russians learned, and we'll talk about some more here, there seem to be parallels between what the Russian Empire, later known as the Soviet Empire, as it devolved and shed territory, it's had trouble maintaining relations with those former parts of its empire here.
Yes, certainly. What the Russians are passing through in Russia now, by means of Russification of all other nations who are actually living under Russia, we passed through that in the first half of the 20th century by means of Turkification of the Kurds, or elimination of the Armenians, and, you know, sending Greek Orthodox to Greece and taking Turks from Greece into Turkey, the swapping of populations, and mm-hmm. so on. These are all painful lessons in our history.
So, we hear quite often that the Islamic world has not formed secular states. Instead, they've either formed strongmen, the kind of people that have run Egypt, or they've sometimes founded kingdoms and stuff, but it's usually been more of an Islamic state and less of a secular democracy. Turkey seemed to fly in the face of that. First of all, is Turkey an Islamic state?
No, Turkey is still largely a secular state, but unfortunately not as democratic as it was 5 years ago.
Right.
We have been passing through a historical accident by means of our improvement of the Turkish democracy. I hope we will turn back to the origins. But by and large, Turkish experiment with a largely Muslim population, religiously observant society, and a secular and democratic system had been labeled as a role model for many Muslim countries.
Yes,
in fact,
exactly, right.
President Obama several times in between 2010 and 2013, these are the years of the so-called Arab Spring, mentioned Turkey as a model state for the Muslim nations of the Middle East. But unfortunately, Turkey has lost its role as a model country, not because we are no longer secular, but because we are no longer really democrat, by means of suppression of the opposition groups and opposition media, of course. And what I observe is actually the Turkish regime is going closer to a kind of Egyptian regime under Hosni Mubarak, mm-hmm. or Iraqi regime under Saddam Hussein. Mm. Both of these people were secular people, but they consolidated power in one hand. They went through a kind of unification of powers, meaning executive, legislative, and judicial organs were all controlled by the same man. And unfortunately, it seems the situation in Turkey is the same.
And it's that description could also seem to apply to Vladimir Putin, who ostensibly is the head of a democratic secular society, but seems to have coalesced power as a strong man and seems to pull all the strings, whether legally or illegally, and seems to control the country in a way that, like you said, Mubarak did in Egypt, or before him Nasser did, and others throughout the Middle East. What is it about this strong man? We don't quite get that strongman image, although I fear we're starting to get it when I listen to the rhetoric of Donald Trump and people like that, who huff and puff and say, that's all I'm going to do is I'm going to blow everything down here.
Well, in fact, I have been in the United States for the last 1 month. I hope that these are all electoral era rhetorics and they are not going to last long, particularly if and ever Trump is elected as the president of the country. I'm sure he's going to turn back to his, you know, norms of the United States. One major, I think, clever move by the United States was to limit the number of eligible terms to two by means of the president.
Mm-hmm.
In the first two terms that the Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan was ruling the country, in fact, he was a Democrat. And Turkey did a lot, and this government, we owe to this government many reforms by means of improvement of the democratic standards of the country, improvement of the minority rights, improvement of freedom of expression in the country. But on the third term, he made a U-turn, and he became what we call in the Middle East nowadays, a democrator.
A democrator, okay.
Yes, a democrator.
A democratic dictator.
It's a democratic dictator. Democratic in the sense that they managed to be elected. They come out of ballot box.
Right. They didn't come out of the military and just
No, they don't come out of
like Saddam Hussein or others.
No, he's elected. that he does have the majority of the public support. Still, I don't see any other name in Turkey that can run and win against him in any election. But this doesn't guarantee a democratic rule, because it comes like a democrat, he rules like a dictator.
So, why again is this such an appealing model in the Middle East and up through the Balkans into Serbian nations? Why is this? People have always said Russia seems to default to, in its entire history, strong men. Are they the only people that can hold these ethnic diverse groups together? Certainly Tito in Yugoslavia held that together for a while until it all fell apart. Saddam held this, I'll say, fake country called Iraq that was created after World War One together. And now, without that strongman, they seem to fall apart. So is it necessary to have a strongman in these areas, or is it simply an appealing proposition to a lot of people in those parts of the world, or is it just lack of historical tradition with democracy like we've developed here?
Lots of choices, though. I think you should add an all choice.
All of the above. Okay.
Yeah, all of the above. Well, the point is this. In my country, I can see a certain level of search for a strong leader among the public. The Turkish people love a strong leader.
Right.
It's a kind of yearning for an Ottoman sultan.
Yes.
In fact, many supporters of the President Erdogan do receive him during the, you know, rallies and so on, with placards opening "The Last Sultan, welcome to our city," and so
on.
Didn't
he build, am I wrong, didn't he build some giant palace or something?
Well, in fact, the palace is, it's a 1,100-room palace.
1,000-room palace, okay.
Yes. And it is named Aksaray in Turkish, which means White House. So it connotes what kind of dream the Turkish president has. He wants to replace President Obama.
There you go. So there is an appeal for strong people in that part
there
of the
is,
world.
There is an appeal.
And historical precedents, we'll go back to the Ottoman Empire and whatnot here.
Certainly. And the names like Putin is not helping at all, because, you know, when people look for strong leaders, they say, look to the Russians. It was almost disintegrating, and this Putin came. You know, you remember Gorbachev as as a not-so-strong leader, a bit democratic, and what happened to Russia? It was almost, you know, a failed state.
Right.
And Putin came and turned Russia to its old might, and Russia once again became an international power.
Putin stripped off his shirt and bare-chested, rode through the streets on his horse, and rallied the people, and all these images he has of himself.
One major difference between Turkey and countries like Russia, or say Egypt, or say Iraq, is all of these countries which did or do have one-man shows are oil-rich countries.
Yes.
Whereas Turkey does not have oil.
Mm.
So for that very basic reason, this is an unsustainable system. You cannot rule a country like Turkey, which continuously needs, you know, economic activism and needs is altogether dependent on trade with the neighboring countries. You cannot just become a democrat in your country and continue on doing well economically.
I love that term, democrat. Yeah. I'll have to use that term here. So, all right, so why do you think, I know you say it differently, is it Erdogan?
Erdogan.
Yes. So why did Erdogan change? He ended a third term, which you say was one too many, and all of a sudden took a turn. Why? What was it that made him turn, and why did people follow that turn?
Well, the point is, first, Erdogan is not content with being the leader of Turkey. He was already the leader of Turkey. He had all the power he wanted. In fact, he cannot have more power because he has all of it. Turning into a democrat doesn't give him anything else, but he is looking for the leadership of the Muslim world, if not the whole world.
Right. And so he himself is of the Islamic faith. He's a Muslim?
He's a I would say, good Muslim by means of, you know, daily performance of religious duties and so on.
Okay.
He knows the religious rhetoric of Islam. He knows how to speak to the Arabs, for example. I joined once to a state trip with him to Egypt in Cairo University. He spoke to defense supporters of Muslim Brotherhood, and I could see the joy in the eyes of the Muslim Brotherhood people that at last they found a Turkish leader who can pronounce Arabic words properly and knows by heart some verses from the Quran and so on. And in fact, he is good in by means of reciting the Quran. He has
he puts on a good
voice.
Show. Okay.
Yes, indeed.
All right, and a bit more of history here that I learned way back when in the 70s when I was at the University of Michigan. I had the privilege to study under some pretty brilliant people back then. And I took a course in Middle Eastern politics just trying to understand what then was just the Arab-Israeli conflict, which now seems to have morphed into this clash between cultures again. We're back to the Crusades. It's Christianity versus Islam, at least in some people's view. So one of the things that I had to discover, I'll never forget this, professor said part of the problem in the Middle East, I don't know if you'll agree with this or not, but part of the problem in the Middle East from his perspective was that there were at least three or four different states that at one time or another in history had ruled the whole area. At one time, this was the Persian Empire, which we now think of as Iran. The Persians had ruled the area. So they think somehow they're entitled to run this whole area. Prior to that or before that, you had the Assyrian Empire. And so Greater Syria sees its role as we really should be the dominant force here. And, of course, the Babylonians, which are now in the area of Iraq, they rule. So each of these areas have a tendency to look to the past and say, you know, this is our rightful place to rule this area. And, of course, the last great group to do this was the Turks and the Ottoman Empire. So you have these, and you have these three kind of cultures. Turkish culture, which, as I understand, goes beyond Turkey. We'll talk about that in a minute. The Turkmen and the Turkmenistan and all these other areas where they show influence in their Turkish languages. And then you have the Persian language and the Iranian people. And then you have this greater conglomerate of Arab peoples that at one time were ruled by all these other people and now themselves somehow want to take control. This Islamic state that wants to arise and claim its position as the caliphate, the speaker of the Islamic world and the ruler of that whole area. So his point was, how do you get all of these groups together when there are at least three or four other players, the Turks, the Iranians, the Arabs, who all see themselves as the rightful ruler of this region?
The observation is right. You know, many nations in the Middle East do believe that they are the inheritors of a mighty empire in the past, and they deserve to rule. And in fact, I think this is good. This is good that we cannot unite on establishing a caliphate, because any kind of unification on the lines of political Islamism in the embodiment of a caliphate will actually reignite the Crusaders exactly at that time. Then we will come to terms with Samuel Huntington, who foresaw a clash of civilizations. Mm-hmm. It's good that the Muslim world cannot unite on political means, but we could have united on peaceful projects, certainly. But caliphate is not a peaceful project at all.
No, it doesn't seem to be.
So
you've got these, and I think that's part of what Americans don't understand. This is just my own observation. Why ISIS is so successful in recruiting people to it, why all of these strong men are successful in recruiting people to their causes, is there's almost a, maybe this is a harsh word, but almost a humiliation of a fear, a feeling of, like in Russia, we lost something. We had something great, and we feel somehow we have lost something. And so anybody who claims to reclaim that glory instantly wins support. Putin is going to somehow regain the lost glory of the Russian people here. Erdogan's maybe going to reclaim the lost glory of the Turkish people here. ISIS is going to reclaim the lost caliphate from the 1500s or 1100s or whenever the last one existed. Somehow there's this tremendous appeal to restoring honor that I don't know that Americans quite get.
This is called post-imperial trauma.
And, right, yeah.
And you know, it's not only unique to the Middle East. Look at France. Look at the appeal that Le Pen does have on the French people.
This is Marine Le Pen, right.
And also look at Hungary, for example. Austria-Hungarian Empire was one of the most stronger empires in the region, and we are seeing a recoming of Hungarian democratorship once again, not a dictatorship.
So are we perhaps in this country susceptible to that same disease? Are we trying to reclaim the lost century of American greatness here, as people accuse Obama and others, where many people say America is losing its greatness and we have to fight to hold on to that, as if that's somehow our rightful position in the world here.
I will tell something to you. I'm not sure whether this observation affirms what you are saying, but it is an alarming, you know, wake-up call. In the Muslim world, most of the Muslim minds are living in a kind of anachronistic situation, meaning the history never ends in the Muslim mind. You know,
that's
the Crusades,
right,
for a Western mind is over. It's something of history. But for a...
Worse than over. People don't even know it existed in this country here. There was a Crusades. When was that?
Whereas in the Muslim Middle East, it is not over. We lived through the Crusades.
Right.
The age of colonies, the colonization of Muslim lands by Britain, by, you know, France mainly, is not over. For France, it is over. For Britain, it's over. But
right,
for Muslim mind, we are still colonized. And the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands is not only in Palestine. It is all over the Muslim world. Mentally, Muslims all over the Muslim world are occupied. And I use this
right
term both metaphorically, meaning preoccupied, but also we feel that we are under occupation. You know,
mm-hmm. And so we're dealing with feelings and perception, I guess.
Feelings and perception. And what this has created is this. The intellectual capacity, the intellectual capital of the Muslim world is poured into, you know, discussions on, you know, anti-Westernism, discussions
reclaiming
on colonization.
Great glory.
Yes, indeed.
Right.
But when I came to the United States, it was, of course, as I said initially, this is an electoral era. It's understandable that people like Donald Trump is trying to build a kind of identity for his power base and so on. But I can see that the American intellectuals are preoccupied with ISIS, whereas
mm-hmm.
ISIS didn't occupy the United States of America. But mentally, the Americans are occupied with the problem.
Amen. We had, and it was horrible, right near us here in San Bernardino,
yeah,
two people who I guess became followers of this through whatever reason there are. They became followers of ISIS and swore adherence, and of course they shot up the place. And 14 people died.
Yeah.
And now, because 14 people died, we're going to spend $14 trillion trying to fight this menace as if it is marching up and down our streets and we're all immediately threatened by it. Horrible that 14 people died, but we've so blown this, in my opinion, into such an overwhelming fear. Everybody's afraid to go out now as if it's going to happen anywhere and everywhere.
And in fact...
Which is what the terrorism is supposed to do.
It's
supposed to create terror.
Yeah. In fact, the discussion is not a healthy discussion.
Mm-hmm.
It's, of course, the United States of America is a global power. It has duties all over the world. It's not only when ISIS hits the United States of America that the Americans need to be concerned.
Right.
When it was back in Syria, United States had to be concerned also. I do understand that, but the discussion is not about solution. Discussion is not about the root causes of terrorism.
Right.
You know, whether Americans should buy guns or not carry guns has nothing to do with the root causes of the terrorism.
Right, exactly.
Okay, or whether we should stop Muslims entering in the United States or not entering in the United States. It has nothing to do with terrorism. In fact, if we block Muslims from entering into United States, we will certainly lose the moderate Muslims, and we will certainly lose our, you know, collaborators against terrorism.
Amen. We drive everybody into their arms here.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here and come back and talk about the roots of terrorism from your perspective, and then we'll talk about what is in the topical news these days, Russia and Turkey. And is that a flashpoint that's going to explode, or is that just a reflaring of old animosities and old empires rubbing up against each other? We're going to look at all that and more as we come back right here in OC Spotlight, right here in Orange County's only community radio station, OCTalkRadio.net.
Wow. Marketing predictions are out for 2015, and marketing success is changing. Did you know that Google is now actively tracking your business and personal brand and online reputation? Online and offline marketing has changed. Google is driving more than 85% of your traffic. And if your brand is inconsistent or has poor mobile usability, your rankings and traffic can suffer in 2015. To learn how your business is currently viewed and what can be done to improve your brand's visibility and authority, contact SunUp Group for a free marketing analysis. It could be a business game changer. Visit www.sunupgroup.com today. or call 877-609-3840, extension 700.
I'm on the observation deck of the Empire State Building to demonstrate how much material Waste Management recycles. As North America's largest residential recycler, last year alone, Waste Management recycled 12.9 million tons. How much is that? Let's do the math. Carry the six. It's enough to fill this building more than 27 times. With experience like that, we're bound to have a program that can help your business recycle. Talk to Waste Management or visit thinkgreen.com.
All right, today we're thinking turkey.com here. We're thinking about, and we're privileged to have with us, see if I can get his name, pronounce your name again here so I don't butcher it.
Kerim Balja.
And somebody who, by his own description, is an opposition voice in a country that seems to be silencing opposition. Let's talk about the atmosphere in Turkey right now, because as I was scrolling through the internet in preparation for this interview, I found a fascinating piece by the Brookings Institute, and they said, Putin and Erdogan, two halves of the same coin. Are they both populists? They're both nationalists. They're both whipping people up, and they're both consolidating power and becoming, as you said, dictators in a democratic society here. Let's talk about that. Is that part of the conflict between these two guys? Two tough guys trying to each fight for their space in the world here?
Yeah, yes, in fact, and they are taking it personal. You know, when the Russian jet was...
Putin says, I've been stabbed in the
yes,
back.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. He's
been stabbed, right?
Yeah, he has been stabbed. He takes it personal, and Erdogan in turn says, Putin knows me very well. He knows how we will respond. It's not about people knowing you as the president very well. This is the Turkish Republic that is going to respond. In fact, Turkey is a member of NATO alliance. It's going to be a unified response of NATO. It's not about you as the leader, but he takes it personal. In fact, when we criticize his manners as the head of the executive, he takes it also as personal. You know, he always says, don't mingle my family, don't speak about my son, and so on. It's all about him, you know.
In the same way that Putin seems to have that same thing. Yes. Any personal criticism against him gets shut down very quickly here. So both countries seems on paper they allow for free press and for democratic opposition parties. But in fact, these groups get shot with water cannons and run off the streets and whatnot. Is it better or worse in Turkey right now than it is in the in Russia, the former Soviet Union, or is it the same?
Well, the point is, Putin has already crashed the opposition, so nobody is actually now...
nobody's dying in the streets because they've already died. Yeah,
yeah, they already died. They're not going out of the street. But when it comes to Turkey, particularly the Kurdish population is still trying to continue
we'll
to
get
fight.
Into the Kurds in a moment here. That's a whole other subject of discussion. But so there is, they are crushing it. Wasn't there, now I don't really know enough about this, but wasn't there something about some old barracks that wanted to get turned into something and it turned into a protest? What was that all about?
Yeah, it was the Gezi Park event back in 2013 when the government wanted to rebuild some old Ottoman era barracks, which is actually a park now. The symbol of Turkish secularism, Taksim Square, and the government wanted to turn the Taksim Square into a shopping mall. not to a mosque. You know, many people think that this government is trying, this government is an Islamist government and trying to bring Sharia to Turkey. It's not true. They are trying to bring a kind of mafia rule which prioritizes neoliberal policies, wild capitalism, and so on. So any shopping mall is much welcomed for the government than
even
a mosque.
Even if it's in the People's Peace Park here or something or whatever. And that seems to be, you could be describing Russia to me, isn't it? Sort of a mafia kind of rule of an oligarchy group that supposedly it's a democratic society, but it's all corrupt. I mean, I've heard estimates that Putin himself has $40 billion stashed away, a lot of it here in the United States and other places here. In fact, I saw somebody on MSNBC once say, so you really want to get Putin where he lives? Start calling out where all his investments are and where all his money is and show the people of Russia he's not just doing this for their greater glory, and it's, a lot of it's his own personal good here, too.
Well, it seems that the Turkish president is one of the richest people in the world also together.
Really? Okay.
I'm not sure as rich as President Putin, but certainly quite rich. And, you know, it's not only about one man being rich, but a group of people who are supporting his one-man show is becoming rich and rich. He's creating his own bourgeoisie.
But these are two former enemies, two former adversaries, two neighbors who have fought often. I had to go back and look. The last time Turkey and Russia fought was World War One, where the Turks sided with the Germans in World War One. In World War Two, the Turks sat out, but really still kind of weren't too supportive of the Russians. There was a Russian-Turkish war that I did not remember, 1877,
yes.
And then prior to that, the famous Crimean War, Charge of the Light Brigade, and all that. So they've had 1850, 1870, 1914, and maybe sort of in the 40s, there have been a history of conflict between these two empires, these two neighbors here. Is this just resurfacing? Is this, as one article I read said, history repeating itself?
Well, history repeating, but the dates you have already given are far, far history. In fact, the history that is repeating itself is a closer history. It's about the Cold War, of 1950s and 1960s, before the détente, that is repeating itself. You know, once upon a time we had this Cuban missile crisis.
Yes,
now we have ISIS crisis.
Right.
At that time also the Soviet Empire was claiming that they are working for universal peace and so on. Now Russia is claiming that they are hitting the terrorists in Syria, whereas actually they are hitting the allies of the United States and allies of Turkey.
Right, and very specifically, which I didn't realize, very specifically the allies of Turkey, these Turkmens. And the Turkmen are a Turkish-speaking people in Syria that, by virtue of the fact that they're related to the Turkish people, there's a sympathy there, there's a connection there, there's a shared common language and culture, and kind of on the border of Turkey. And the other thing I saw, which I thought was very interesting, I hadn't thought about this, but I saw this in an article, is that Turkey, like most empires, wants to have some sort of buffer around it. And just as the Soviet Union took over Eastern Europe, not because they really wanted to run Eastern Europe, but they wanted a buffer. You know, they go back to Napoleon invading, and they want to have this long stretch of buffer states that you got to fight your way through before you get to the motherland. Mm-hmm. In the same sense, Turkey seems to be trying to establish a buffer zone with this Turkmen group. Is that correct?
It is correct. It's not only a buffer zone that will prevent expansion of Assad armies into Turkey or ISIS terrorism into Turkey. It will also prevent from Kurds, which are enemies of Turkey, also in Syria, to create their continuous zone of autonomy. If they do manage to do so, the Kurds have three different areas of control in Syria. If they unite them, they will certainly look for autonomy and in the long run for independence. And the Turkish establishment is stuck with the idea of Kurdish autonomy in the region, meaning Kurdish autonomy in Turkey also. Turkey has the largest Kurdish population in the world, so it's understandably is afraid of any kind of possible Kurdish state.
Because they would
being
split off, they'd take territory and form a new country.
Well, there is this feeling that if there is an independent state in Syria or in Iraq, then our Kurds in Turkey will also say, okay, why not us also?
Right.
There is that fear. And the Turkmens are actually preventing that from happening. In fact, ISIS is also preventing that from happening. Mm. In that sense, whereas ISIS is number one enemy of the West, of the United States in Syria, ISIS is a useful enemy for Turkey. It's an enemy, yes, but it's a useful enemy. It prevents the Kurds from creating a continuous zone of influence.
And that's why Americans struggle to understand this. We want good guys and bad guys. We want World War II, the Nazis versus the good guys here. And when you go into places like Syria, you've got Alawite Shiites, which are a subsect of Shiites.
Yes.
You've got Sunni and Shiites that split, back in the 1100s or something.
Yes.
Here, over the
yes.
succession to Muhammad here. And one group went one way, another way, and since then they've hated each other and fought with each other. And one subsect of the Shiite minority is this Alawite group that lives in the mountains of Syria along the Lebanese border or whatever. And they, for whatever reason, got control of this country called Syria when the French and British divided up the Middle East. How did the Alawites end up in control of Syria?
Well, amazingly, Alawites used to be mountain people, as you said. They're
right.
Dealing with agriculture, not rich, not in control of the bureaucracy. But one particular man played a great role, Hafez al-Assad, the father of Bashar al-Assad.
The current...
He managed to become an influential colonel in the air forces, and he managed to convince his own community to move into the army. You know,
And that's what they came to dominate.
Yes, right? In fact, they first started to control the air forces, and later on the Mukhabarat in Arabic, the intelligence services,
the secret police,
the secret police of Syria, and the Syrian secret police is the worst of all.
Is it really?
It is. You know, among the Arabs, they say when you say secret police of Egypt, it is secret police of Egypt. When you say just secret police, it is secret police of Syria. So it is the secret police par
excellence.
It's the
most secret, right?
Yeah,
okay.
Most secret.
So somehow this Alawite group took over, and then, of course, and the rest of the community's view, dominated everything, kept everybody down, including the Sunni majority in the country.
Yes.
So at some point, when the Arab Spring erupted, they said, enough with this guy, and people wanted to throw him off. And as somebody said to me a long time ago in an article I read also supported this, it's no secret that why he started bombing his own people. This is a fight to the death, because they felt if they lost that they were going to be next. They were going to be persecuted and killed or whatnot. So this is a fight to the death for this Alawite community.
Certainly, and there are the lessons of Iraq, actually. It is exactly what happened in Iraq. By the American invasion, the previously dictatorial Sunni forces, which were in minority in Iraq, they lost their position of control and domination, and a Shiite governance came to power, and the majority became dictators now, and the Sunnis started to suffer. In fact, this is what gave birth to ISIS in the long run.
Right.
So think of yourself as an Alawite in Syria, and you are observing what's going on in Iraq. You realize that, well,
if we lose, we're going to
lose.
Really,
we lose everything.
Yeah.
It's not just we will lose the prime ministry, you know.
Right. So you've got this one group fighting for that, and you've got certain Christian communities, aren't there Druze and other, or the Druze are sort of a mixture of Muslim and Christian. I've never quite understood who the Druze are, but
yes.
And then you've got other Alawite, you've got other Christians and Maronites and other groups that live in this area, and pockets of Crusaders that have survived through the centuries, and then you have, of course, the Sunni and traditional Sunni and Shiite, all these religious groups fighting each other, and then on top of it, we've got this ethnic element. We've got Turkmens in the north, we've got Kurds in the north, and they don't sort of get along, and they're fighting for their own reasons, and all of this mess.
And on top of religious and ethnic sectarian groups, we have to put the tribal dynamics of Syria.
That's right. Another thing we struggle with to understand.
Yeah.
So people, am I first and foremost a member of a tribe? Am I first and foremost a member of a religion, of a region, of a culture, of an ethnic group, of a country? Where is my allegiance first?
That is the issue. When you said a fake state of Iraq, that is not because it was created artificially by the British and the Russian, drawing the new map after the Ottomans. It's because it didn't take into consideration the tribal dynamics or sectarian dynamics of those lands.
Why were the Europeans so stupid? I'm sorry to say this, after the war, and why didn't the U.S. Through Wilson, Woodrow Wilson, ever insist more in drawing these lines more intelligently? Africa is still fighting to this day. All these countries, the Balkans, have fought forever over these artificial lines that they drew, where they split ethnic groups and religions in half. And the Kurds, why weren't the Kurds given a homeland back then?
Yeah, the Kurds are unfortunately in four different countries, and they were not given a land. And it is, well, many people in my region, believe that this was intentionally and deliberately done in a stupid way so that we will always fight with each other.
I've heard that. Somebody said as long as we divide them up, they'll always be fighting with each other, and then we can just come in and get what we want.
It is the famous divide-and-rule strategy that is attributed to the British.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Exactly. Divide these people up, let them fight amongst themselves, and they will never unite, and so we'll always have control over them and get what we want, which is their oil everywhere or the resources here.
That is the kind of perception of mismanagement of the remapping of the Middle East and of sub sub-Saharan Africa, unfortunately.
So, and I have to, I hope this doesn't offend you, because I know this is a very sensitive subject, but I got to bring up Armenians here. We have a very large Armenian community in Southern California, mostly up around Glendale, but a very large community here as well. And, of course, the Armenians, to this day, feel that they got caught in a genocide.
Yes.
That started during World War One. Because I'm not sure why, because they tended to support the Russians or something, and that turned into an outright slaughter, and they drove them down into what was supposed to be Syria, and most of them died on the way there.
Well, if we just...
And the Turkish seem to be reluctant, the Turkish government reluctant to admit this or talk about it or even acknowledge it here.
Well, the point is this. If we just say that the relocation of the Armenians that started during the First World War, it was only because they supported the Russians, we will not do justice to the Armenians. In fact, Armenian pogroms, or the term President Obama cleverly formulated in Armenian, started far before then. In 1880s, also the Armenians were massacred in Ottoman lands.
And you got to go back and study history. Pogroms are an event that a name they gave to religious persecutions or ethnic persecutions in Russia, in Turkey, and all these areas. The Jews had pogroms against them under the Tsars, where they just came in and slaughtered the villages and whatnot. I'm not sure why these poor people were all selected for this, but for whatever reason, they were targeted and hit pretty hard at different times in history here. Yes. So you're saying the Armenians suffered the same pogroms,
certainly.
Right?
Well, the point is this. You know, already during the Tanzimat era, this is the reformation era of the Ottoman Empire, back in the second half of the 19th century, the Ottoman intellectuals believed that as long as we have so many sectarian, religious, ethnic, linguistic differences, we cannot create a solidarity. Mm. So there was this nation-state project.
Ethnic purity or whatever.
Yeah, homogeneity. You know, right. they believe if we have a small but unified nation, it will perform better than an empire, they believe. Mm-hmm. So there was this Turkification project of the Ottoman elite. This has nothing to do with the Republican elite. They continued on with it, but it was already there during the Ottomans. And in fact, the purificationists usually utilize times of war to get rid of their, you know, others.
Yes, the others.
And the Armenians were the very first, and of course the grievances of Armenians outnumber the grievances of Assyrians, for example, that followed in 1920s, mm-hmm. or the Jews that followed in early 1950s, or the Greeks that were, you know, sent to Greece through a swap of population. The
right.
numbers are huge, and well, of course, being killed or annihilated, it cannot be compared to being swept, but when you go to Greece and listen to the stories of Greeks who were born in Istanbul, their yearning of the Bosphorus and so on, mm-hmm. then you will realize that we have created lots of pains out there.
And in fact, look at the island of Cyprus, which apparently is maybe close to coming up with some closing a chapter there, where the island is divided between the Greeks and the Turks, and it goes back to what you're talking about, this hatred, this fight between those empires, those peoples for history too.
And this was done in an era where the United States of America was actually appealing to others. You know, mm-hmm. the United States became a nation of immigrants, and whereas
we are a nation of others, yeah.
Whereas we were trying to get rid of others,
and we said, "Give us your huddled masses yearning to be free," as they mm-hmm. say in the Statue of Liberty here, which is ironic. I'm going to give my own little soapbox here. Why are we as Americans every so often so afraid of others? I'm Irish Catholic. When they came over in droves in the 1850s because of the potato famine, they're Catholics, they're agents of the Pope, and we need to drive these Catholics out here. And there was the Know-Nothing parties, and the Ku Klux Klan was formed not just against African-Americans, but against Irish as well, and Catholics. And then later on, we have famous hatred of other ethnic groups as they come over. And now there is this huge collection of others that the Donald Trumps are vilifying. The Mexicans flooding across the border that are all rapists and drug dealers, the homosexuals, the feminists, the African-Americans still. We as a country country of collection of others, cast off others, every so often fall into that same fear.
Well, distinguished Professor Bernard Lewis wrote about the American identity back soon after the 9/11 calamity, and he claimed that the United States of America is so heterogeneous that it needs others out there in order to claim a certain kind of unity.
Oh, so the only unity we have is we're not them.
Yes.
There's them and there's us somehow.
This is the traditional, Cartesian understanding of the world. You know, there are only blacks and whites. There are no gray zones in the world,
right.
And so on. Despite the fact that the world is all gray.
Right.
You know, none of us are black and white.
No. I've always understood, why do we describe in this country we can't get over racism here? And when you call one group black and the other group white, that's a pretty big difference. That's about as far apart as you can get here. You know, if we don't just say they're African Americans, they're black and we're white. You know, one's good, one's bad, one's evil, one's right. Extreme polar images there just by the words that you choose here.
Dirty joke in Turkish. You know, I hope
nobody... Good. We want to hear a dirty joke in Turkish.
Well, I hope nobody is offended from this, but this is about a certain group of people called Laz in Turkey who are Caucasian people who are always, you know, find clever solutions to problems.
Okay. And what are they called?
Laz. Laz.
How would you spell that?
L-A-Z.
Okay.
Laz.
Okay.
So Laz came to United States and he was waiting for a bus, and the bus came, and suddenly white and blacks started to fight to go in first, and he didn't understand what is the problem, and he said, "What is the problem?" And the Afro-American says, "You know, these white people, you know, they don't let us in the bus. They want always us to sit on the back and so on."
Right.
And the whites claimed that the Afro-Americans didn't have the same right, and said, and the Turkish law said, "Why don't you think that you are all blue for some time?" They said, "Okay, this is a beautiful solution." This is a solution. Okay, that he said, "Let us go in." Of course, this time everybody wanted to go in as blue. And he looked and he looked and he said, "No, this is not going to work. Let the light blues first and the dark blues later."
Exactly.
So the lesson of the joke says, sometimes you may not escape the Cartesian understanding of the world.
The Cartesian understanding.
The Cartesian says, you know, the dichotomy. Cartesian understanding that there is true and false. There are no different, no zones between true and false, or good and bad. There are no zones.
One or the other. Which side are you on here?
Yeah.
As President Bush said, you're for us or against us. You know,
that's exactly
right.
Exactly.
All right. So we're in a couple of minutes. We have to wrap up. Give us an understanding of what's in the news right now and what's going to happen. And I'll give you three areas to cover here. One. What's going to happen with ISIS in Turkey? Is Turkey going to step in? Are they going to invade? Are they going to send troops and planes? Are they going to be the boots on the ground we're anxious for? Two, what's going to happen to the poor Kurds in all of this? Are they going to keep fighting? Are they going to break off and find their own country here and unite with? They pretty much have broken off in Iraq. They're trying to break off in Syria and all join together. And three, what's going to happen with the Russians? Is this the flashpoint we've been fearing? Is this going to start World War III?
Well, I think the Turkish president badly wants Turkish army to enter into Syria,
mm-hmm.
because he believes the Turkish army and he himself as the justice giver or organizer of the Middle East, that he's going to solve the problems in the Middle East. But
right.
the Turkish army does not have that potential. I believe it will be a calamity, a catastrophe for the Turks, and in fact it is going to reignite the traditional enmity between the Turks and the Arabs. Many Turks think that everybody loves them, but the Arabs do not love Turks. And when you ask
again,
the Arabs,
three ethnic groups, the Turks, the Arabs, and the Persians all seem to be, in one way or another, still fighting with each other for control
of
this area. Right?
Yes, indeed. But in the end, somebody has to enter into Syria and Iraq and has to make
the
fight.
We're begging somebody to go other than us. We don't want to go.
Well, the point is this. Even Secretary of State Kerry said it may be even the Syrian army that will do the
we
job.
We may have to go back and make friends with Assad and say, all right, you go do it.
Yeah. Well, the point is this. In fact, if we could convince Assad to move into a kind of interim period of reforms in Syria, it would be beautiful to push the reset button and turn back to pre-Arab Spring times.
Why can't we split these countries up? When Joe Biden suggested that he was vilified, and yet I heard somebody the other night, I think it was actually Ted Cruz or somebody like that that surprised me and said, why don't we split these countries up again here into what are probably more natural states? Why can't the Alawites take part of Syria and be there where they are or else and then split the country up? Why is this so evil to even talk about redrawing these maps that were artificially drawn 100 years ago?
The point is this. There are no natural limits to dividing groups.
It's not a river or something that separates
them.
No,
it's not. It's not only about that. Let us say that we are going to divide Syria on religious sectarian lines.
Right.
Okay? Sunni, Shiite, Alawite. And Christian,
right.
And Druze, and so on.
Right.
There are four major groups.
Right.
But the point is, some of the tribes are both Sunni and Shiite. Mm. Some of the tribes are both Christian and Muslim.
I see. So what criteria do you use to separate people? Is it by tribal allegiance? Is it by religious allegiance? Is it by ethnic allegiance?
And if you let we decide that, okay, Christians will have their own land, but Christians have Orthodox Arab Christians and Maronite Christians.
Who still adhere to the Roman Catholic faith.
Yes, indeed.
Right.
So there are differences also there. So, you cannot stop there. You know, then you will go back to the tribal times where there was no state and anarchy ruled.
Right.
So that is the fear in the region. That is the reason why, for example, when Saddam was ousted in Iraq, there was a consensus between Turkey, Iran, and the United States that the Unitarian structure of Iraq has to be saved.
Well, which seems crazy because it's pretty much broken into three parts anyway right now, and the Iranians have basically moved in and taken over the Shiite part, de facto or de jure, whichever way you want to thought, in law or in practice, and the Sunnis are by definition looking for somebody to strong man, so they're fleeing to accepting ISIS. North, the Kurds pretty much call their own show here.
Well, the point is, there are some cities that are undividable. You know, Baghdad have a Kurdish, and also Kirkuk. This is the center of richness. You know, most
oil
rich
and
oil and gas reserves
in
the world.
Kind of up in the north, where the Kurds it's on the edge.
Already controlled by the Kurds, but of course the central government, the Shiites, claim a role, and it used to be a Sunni area. So everybody wants Kirkuk.
So your prediction is the Turk do want to go in, and maybe the Americans will encourage him because we want somebody other than us this time, but you think it would be a disaster if they did so.
It is going to be a disaster. The best possible option is the Kurds doing the job.
Mm-hmm. That's what everybody seems to turn to. They're tough fighters.
And they're tough fighters.
They're
willing
to do this.
And the point is this. We Turks do not have anything to lose in Syria if we don't go into, but the Kurds have everything to lose in Syria.
Do the Turks want to arm the Kurds? Aren't they going to come back after they win and turn it on the Turks here? And
that is the basic issue in Syria. Our list of enemies do not overlap with the list of enemies of United States.
Right.
You know, well, Americans think Kurds as allies. We believe them are number one enemies.
Right.
Americans say number one enemy is ISIS. We say, yes, it's an enemy, but it's a useful enemy. Americans say we have to get rid of Jabhat al-Nusra. There are all claims that Turkish government is helping Jabhat al-Nusra.
Really?
Yes, and Americans say
Nusra is what's left of the Al-Qaeda group.
Left of the Al-Qaeda group. The list is not unified. It's not overlapping, and I'm not speaking about the list of the Russians. It is upside down.
Yeah, right.
And Europe does have a different list. Europe cares about refugee flux. So they don't care about what's happening in Syria.
Solve it, because we can't take out 10 million people moving into our nations here.
Yeah. So the priority of Germany is to stomp the refugees, you know, not in Syria, not necessarily, but certainly in Turkey.
Right.
So their priority is this. Under such circumstances that NATO allies do not have a unified list of enemies, do not have a unified list of priorities.
Or support, they don't even know who to support.
Yeah. But the point is this, good to see that Putin is involved. When Putin is in picture, then suddenly the NATO allies come to terms and say, okay, we have to unite.
Right.
Because this is too large for anybody to tackle.
We only got one common enemy, and he's
He is Putin. So it most probably Turkey will come to terms with the United States by means of training and equipment of Kurdish militia in Syria, and the Kurds are going to do
the job. And do the Turks and the Russians continue to fight, or do they let economic interests? I didn't realize that the Turks are the number one consumer of Russian natural gas, and they want it to flow into that area. The Turks have turned to the Russians to build nuclear power plants in the country. I didn't know all this. So there's a huge economic interest to keep working with the Russians, or do they fall back into this long history that we talked about? Two empires, two different religions, two strong men elbowing each other. What happens?
Well, the point is, you know, the numbers are quite alarming. Turkey is dependent on 66% dependent on Russian oil and gas.
Wow.
And we don't
not from the southern area, not from the Middle East. They get it from Russia. They don't get oil and gas.
We get oil and gas from Russia and China. It's Russia and Iran, basically. Mm-hmm. No other nations. We have signed a new deal with Qatar to buy liquefied gas, but it is much more expensive and it is not easy to bring them with tankers. It has to pass through the Suez Channel, which is under the control of Egypt, which does hate Turkish government.
Yes, right. That's a whole other series of discussions.
Well, in fact, today in the morning, there was a news item in Israeli press that claimed that Turkey and Israel at last decided to solve their problems diplomatically, you know, because of the fight in Blue Marmara incident. Turkey does not have an embassy in Israel, and the diplomatic relations are...
As I recall, what happened is over the Israelis tried to stop some flow of arms into Gaza because they
said it was not a flow of arms. It was a humanitarian aid or
aid ship. Yes, right. Yeah. And they claimed there might be guns in there.
Yes, indeed. They took on the boat and...
Came from Turkey and they stopped it.
Yes, they stopped it and 10 Turkish citizens were killed during the fight on board the ship. This was on the May 13th of 2010. For the last 5 years, we don't have proper diplomatic relations, but Israel has gas.
So maybe we'll forget about that.
Yeah,
you can give us some
exactly. The sides agreed, and the agreement does have a particular article, telling that Turkey is going to buy gas, natural gas from Israel, and in fact, Israel does need Turkey as a route to reach to the European market.
See, this is what drives us crazy in this country. We tend to think everything in economic terms. Okay, so you guys hate each other, but you need this, I need this. How much do you want to stop hating each other? $100 million and you guys shake hands. $200 million is to bury these five-century divisions, and tend to think economics trumps everything, but not necessarily.
In the case of Turkey and Israel, it was even much more smaller, $20 million.
That was one of those.
Yeah, that was the figure. And Israel accepted to pay $20 million in compensation for the lost lives and apologized. Israel already apologized.
Right.
It was something brokered by President Obama, but Israel wasn't able to agree by means of compensation, and they agreed now.
I've already exceeded the time we normally do, but I ask you one question here, and please be honest. We, in the middle of this debate right now, so many people say on the Republican side that Obama's been weak and has weakened the U.S. position, and our allies don't like us, and we're weaker in the world. Is that your opinion? Or because he certainly did try efforts to mend relations with the Islamic world. The famous speech where he almost seemed to be apologetic to Muslims for what some of the stuff we'd done when he went to Egypt. The efforts, as you're saying, to broker agreements between Israel and Turkey and stuff. Is there more to the story, or does that how the Turks see? How do the Turks see? And how do you see him, and how do the Turks see Obama?
Well,
the
point is this. Turks love conspiracies, and a lot of Turks believe that President Obama is actually a Muslim.
Really? Just like my late great father did, you know. He's really a Muslim agent who's been raised to infiltrate America here, yeah.
And
really?
In fact, Turkey has one of the highest anti-Americanism sentiments, but President Obama is still likened in Turkey.
Hmm.
So we have this absurdity in international public surveys that the Turkish people hate the United States of America, but they love the president of the United That still is the case.
Okay. All right. Any final thoughts, predictions of what will happen here? Anything we should watch for? This is being recorded in December at the end of 2015. So if you're listening to it in a podcast next year, in 5 years or 2 years, give us a prediction and people can judge you by this here. They'll be able to say, oh, he knew what he was talking about, or no, boy, that guy was wrong. Give us some prediction here.
Well, I think with the involvement of Russia in Ukraine and then in Syria. This is not going to end in Syria. We will have other...
They've got a naval base there, for Pete's sake. They've been there for a while. Yeah, right.
Well, Syria is a Russian headquarters in Mediterranean.
It's their only naval base outside of Russia here.
Yes.
So
Under such conditions, I don't see that the NATO-Russia conflict will cease to exist. It will continue, and with every stage, it will become even stronger and stronger. So I think these are the initial days of the Second Cold War that we are passing through. The United
States.
So not
a hot war, but a cold war.
It's not a hot war. And in fact, with the experience of the First Cold War, I don't think that the sides will be so stupid to go into a hot war. But certainly, the Russian involvement will actually turn other problems like ISIS, other problems like dictatorships in the Middle East, into secondary or trivial issues. This is not a good news for me, for example, because under such conditions, I think the Western alliance will not be willing to speak about the breachings of democratic rights in Turkey or crackdown on media in Turkey. Each time we will try to appeal to the Americans, they will say, we are dealing with Russia.
We got bigger problems. Right.
And as long as we got that bigger problem, we will fail to address the root causes of Islamist terrorism also, and we won't be able to get rid of that problem. Despite the fact that we have all the means to fight that fight, not militarily, but certainly on discursive basis, we may fail to do so, and we may use all our intellectual capacity to fight a fight in the Cold War between Russia, China, Iran, and the Western allies.
Wow. A lot to think about. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming. Do you ever plan to come back to this area again? Because we'd love to continue the conversation. I still like to find out, what Turkey is like as a country. Is it open to import, export? Can you do business there? All these kind of questions that I'd love to find out someday, but we're out of time here.
Well, certainly Turkey is going to be a destination for businessmen, particularly if there's going to be a crisis. But these are going to be not the businessmen for investment, but for loan restructuring, so finance industry. But many Turkish businessmen are looking for opportunities to move to the western coast, and we may see more and more Turkish businessmen moving out of Turkey with fear of persecution in Turkey because of their political views and so on.
Same thing we're seeing with the Chinese. We talked about a number of shows. I'm not trying to be alarmist, but there's quite a number of Chinese moving here, parking money here. EB-5 program, where they're bringing over $1 million or more, the millionaire visa, and you buy, set up a property, and then you get a visa over here. Many people feel that they're doing that as a get-out-of-jail-free card, as an escape vehicle if things blow up in China. So we've talked about it. There are whole developments here in Irvine that are being sold out to Chinese. They're coming in with cash. They're parking their families here. They're parking their relatives here. They're buying businesses here, parking money here, just in case things get out of control in China here someday.
Well, things have already got out of control in Turkey, so I will be traveling around the United States.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming by again. And how do they reach the Pacifica Institute? Give us the website and everything if they want to know. Because you're not giving a talk here right now. You're just passing through. But they do have events coming up throughout the year talking about Turkish events. I think it's PacificaInstitute.org. Yeah. PacificaInstitute.org. If you want to hear more about the relations in the world with Turkey and what's happening right here in our own backyard. And you have a branch here. Everybody's nodding here in Orange County. You have branches elsewhere. Let's see. Go look up Pacifica. I'm looking Los Angeles, Orange County, Silicon Valley, San Diego, San Francisco, all sorts of places, as well as some other states on the western United States. Thank you guys for coming so much here. And we appreciate you taking some time out to tell us what's happening in Turkey here. I'm still not sure I got it all, but it's a lot to digest here. Thanks so much.
Thank you.